him. He obtained his bachelor's degree at the University of Melbourne, and then in 1986 his PhD in statistics in La Trobe University, which is also in Melbourne. He actually is currently the academic director of the master's program in analytics and also the online program. And before that, he was actually department head of statistics at Texas A&M from 2005 to 2014. And prior to that, he was actually in Australia at the University of New South Wales. I should mention that in terms of the general interest of Professor Sheather, he works on flexible regression methods for big data. He's also worked on smoothing methods for non-parametric statistics. He's also been involved with the LASSO system, again, for handling very large data sets. And the other part that's very interesting is the actual applications. He's developed a number of predictive models for the oil gas industry, for healthcare, and financial services, among others. I should also mention that in terms of, his research, he's actually supervised about 7 PhD students and over 50 master's students, about half and half statistics, the other half from analytics. He has over 80 publications and something like 50 proceedings and 2 books. And the other thing, he's been highly cited. He has actually over 10,000 citations from Google Scholar and an H index of 36. Because of the great work that he's done, he's been recognized a number of ways. Just let me mention 3 of them. He's a fellow of the American Statistical Association. He also received the Award Statistics and Chemistry Award, again, from the American Statistical Association. And I have been told, actually, that he's an outstanding lecturer, and I'm sure we'll find that out, because, for example, he also got the Texas A&M Distinguished Teaching Award. So I think without further ado, Professor Sheather is going to talk to us about flexible statistical modeling methods for big data. So, Simon, you're welcome, and thank you very much for agreeing to give the talk. So, it's all yours. Can you hear us?
Hello?
Yes, hello. Boy, this is so flaky.
Someone sent a message, I
guess. Yes, hello. Yes, hello. Simon? Yes, hello? Yes, hello, Simon?
He said he was calling from his cell phone, so he may have just lost reception. There's nothing we can do then about that. I'm sure he'll reach out by email or something if he can't get through.
Yes, hello? We supposedly have the phone because we don't trust the WebEx communication. Yes. Yes, hello.
I'm on the phone. I had to call, the phone number on the invite. The WebEx thing went to some kind of computer audio based thing that didn't seem to work with my computer.
Yeah.
So I just called in.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, we don't use the audio from WebEx. We don't trust it. So, okay. So probably you missed. I gave an introduction, told all the great work that you've done, something about your background and your research interests. So, then I think again, without further ado, if you'd like to get started with the talk, Simon.
The outline of my talk is I'm going to start with a personal history. Because I always think that you get an insight into the way people think by understanding where they came from. I'm going to do some definitions of what big data is and what predictive models are, because there's some confusion there. And then I'm going to introduce some techniques using some examples. The first example is about modeling gas production. Second example is about modeling NFL fan ratings. The third and fourth examples include taxi fares in New York City and Southwest airline ticket prices. And then we're going to move on to time series models and talk about Chicago taxi fares and modeling exchange rates. And I'm going to finish with an example of a current student's project predicting weekly U.S. rig count. So, As Ignacio said, I was born and educated in Melbourne, Australia. Seems a long way away from here. In February 2005, I moved from Sydney to College Station. You'll see the top picture is that iconic one of Sydney Harbour. I lived on Sydney Harbour in Mossman Bay in a penthouse apartment, and you'll see the red arrow actually pointing to that apartment. And the bottom right-hand picture is the view from that apartment. And one of the yachts there was named Uptown Girl. And when I used to host graduation parties, I would say that was Billy Joel's summer boat. But it wasn't, of course. So when I first taught in the US, a lot of the students asked me about my ancestry, and I grew up thinking that I was from convict stock, as we say in Australia, because most Australians from the UK were, their forebears were convicts. Well, it turns out that's not true. So Henry Sheather was born in Brick, Sussex, and died in Sydney, Australia, some 68 years later. He and his brother were agricultural labourers who could read and write, and they worked for Governor MacArthur, actually, as farmers, working on producing food to feed the convicts. My grandfather, James, is the first Sheather born in Australia, and my father lived to be almost 90. I won't tell you when my birthday was, but you can probably guess. All right, so here's a little bit of fun. I have three brothers, Simon, Martin, Andrew, and Tim. And so you have to guess who's who. So I'm the professor, I'm the nerdy-looking one. I'm the oldest. I was born in November 1 year. Martin was born November the next year. He's the shifty-looking one because he's the banker. Andrew was born the December after that. My mother was the same. And then she had 1 year off of good behavior. And the youngest, Tim, was born. And he runs a car racing team in Australia. So quite an eclectic background. So in March 2005, I took over being the head of the Department of Statistics at Texas A&M. At that time, we were the third largest Department of Statistics in the country. And I'm very proud of all of the achievements of the department. In fall 2007, I started an online master's program in statistics. Nice. With just 20 students. We've had more than 200 graduate in the 10 years, and we currently have around 400 students online. In 2012, we formed a company. So when I go out and talk to companies, they typically want to recruit some of our students, they want to put students on some of our programs, or they want help with industrial problems. And we weren't able to do the third thing. So what we decided to do was set up a company. Myself and two colleagues, we own 1% of the company and the university owns 99%. And then in 2013, in conjunction with the business school here at Texas A&M, we began an MS Analytics program. It's a 5-semester part-time program taught Tuesdays and Thursday evenings in Houston, where about half the students are. The other half are around the country, and they watch live broadcasts of classes. So that's the background. I have a lot of practical experience, as you'll see. There's a wonderful book by Schonenberger and Kukier. One of them is an academic and the other one writes for The Economist, and they're about to put out the second edition of this book, and I have students read it because it has a lot of stories and it broadens their horizon. I like a lot of what they say. In terms of definitions of big data, there's no rigorous definition of big data. Initially it was about volume. It had grown so large it could no longer fit into the memory of computers used to process. For most undergraduate students, big data is anything that they can't fit into Excel, certainly for business students. In many areas, however, a shift has taken place from collecting some data to gathering as much as possible, and if feasible, getting everything, N equals all. So I taught a young man MBA Statistics 1 and MBA Statistics 2 in 1990 in Australia, and he's now the vice president of a big company in London, and I have all of their customer data. Some more than 4 billion rows, and I have their customer behavior for the previous 2 years, and my job is to predict for each customer what their behavior, their buying and purchasing behavior, is going to be in the next year. So this is the essence of big data, is we want models for not the mean or the median. We want to be able to model every person or every part of the population. Sometimes, though, big data is not necessarily big. We've had students in the analytics program who work in business-to-business markets where they may have less than 50 customers. So it's still big data. It's still intricate because you want to develop models for each of the customers, but it's not necessarily something that you have trouble fitting in memory when you process the model. So there are two broad types of statistical models. The first one is an explanatory model that is interpretable. So we understand which predictors have what effect. And sometimes you actually have to have that by law. If you're a lender in Texas and you use a model to screen customers, you have to explain why a loan application was not approved. So you can't use some of the machine learning neural network techniques because it's difficult to explain why somebody was denied a loan. And certainly my experience is that if you work with this, they often want to understand the interpretability part. But if we move to predictive modeling, we want something that can work quickly and very effectively. A credit card company wants to predict in real time whether a credit card transaction is fraudulent or not. So you swipe your card at the gas station, and this person lives, it's me, I live in Texas, I travel a lot, but in West Virginia, somebody's trying to buy gas. They have to decide whether that is a fraudulent transaction or not in real time. So clearly they're not interested in the interpretability here, they want something to work very effectively and very quickly, and that's where machine learning can work well. I believe in the KISS principle from Arnold Zellner, who was at the University of Chicago, and here KISS means keep it sophisticatedly simple. You want the model sophisticated enough such that the subject matter expert are unable to criticize it too much, but you want it simple enough that it's able to be used in practice. And if you look at Einstein's quote, which is just a beautiful one, you want to make the model as simple as possible, but no simpler. So, often in predictive modeling with big data is we have many, many potential predictors and we want to reduce the number of predictors to a manageable set to make the model sophisticatedly simple. I love Wikipedia. I've done depositions wherever I go and give talks. My experience with lawyers is that they often have the Wikipedia page. So I love what Wikipedia says. And here it talks about predictive analytics making predictions and capturing relationships. So they want the best of both worlds. They want predictive models and explanatory models. And my experience of working with industry is if you say that, yes, we can increase your customer retention rate by 20%, they're going to want to know how and look into that very carefully, especially if they're going to have to invest dollars into your suggestion. So what I have learned over and over is subject matter expertise is the most important thing in model development. If we had a competition where we just did machine learning on one side of the house and on the other side of the house we used subject matter experts and statistical modeling, including machine learning, the latter approach, in my experience, always wins. And this example here is a classic one. Lending Club is a peer-to-peer lending company. So if you want to start up a restaurant, good luck trying to get the bank to lend you the money, but you could borrow it from Lending Club. And they have put all their data, made all their data public, and the data dictionary has hundreds of variables. And you're interested in trying to predict who is going to have their loans charged off, as in they've given up on you, or they've actually defaulted. And the best predictor here is the difference in FICO score. That's your current FICO score minus what the original one was. So if your FICO score has gone down by, say, 140
by 180 points, you can see that you're predicted to have a 75% chance of charging on. And I have done this exercise where I've used variable selection techniques to try and figure out the best model. And this FICO difference always does better. And I learned that from a subject matter expert. So if you start with the FICO difference and then add more terms, you get a much better model. And it's ironic now. You can download the Lending Club data on Kaggle, www.kaggle.com, and they don't have the current FICO score in the data set. So they realize, too, that that's the magic source ingredient. So what I want to do is start with an oil and gas example. And this is the data's taken from a book, a Wiley book by Keith Holdaway, who works for SAS. He's actually a good buddy of mine. So here, this is, we're going to try and model the 12-month non-zero gas production in unconventional reservoirs in the Barnett Shale in North Texas. The primary goal is to figure out which operational variables most impact performance, and the initial focus is on proppant and frac fluid volume. And they're interested in trying to optimize proppant usage because it's expensive and they hence want to save money, not use it unnecessarily. So if you look at Holdaway's book, and he has a published paper as well, in phase one, what they did was actually use an algorithm, sequential R-squared-based algorithm, to try and get around 50 potential predictors down to 10 of them. So I took their ones, their variables, and I added a couple of others because this is enough to illustrate the point that I'm going to try and make. So the first thing we're going to do is look at the correlation matrix of the predictors. It's a predictors are very highly correlated, we have some instability in the regression equation. We have what's called variance inflation, and the coefficients are hard to interpret. Sometimes you'll get a negative coefficient when it doesn't make sense at all, well, these two things should be positive related. And you'll notice I've taken a log transformation of all of the predictors because they're very skewed except for the number of stages. And using logs will enable us to estimate percentage change. If I increase profit by 1%, how much does what is the percentage change in gas production? And of course, we want to look at plots. And here is a plot, a scatter plot matrix of all the predictors against each other. And predominantly, the dots are red. That's the training data. Here I use the 65% split and the 35% for the blue validation data. And you can see that even after the log transform, there are a bunch of outliers. So if you look in the first column, this proppant has a bunch of left side low outliers. You can see why multicollinearity is not a big problem. The only two highly correlated predictors are lower perforation and upper perforation. So if you go and you just use a naive model, so I'm sure Holdaway didn't do this. I'm not trying to criticize him. He's a good buddy of mine. So if we just put all of those terms in as a linear function, we get a model where the R-squared is over 40%. We find that, interestingly, location, location, location is very important. What county is the well? What is the latitude and longitude of the well? They appear right up near the top. Now, the question here is this a valid model? What I see over and over is people put in models with many predictors and they don't go through the step of actually ensuring that the model is correctly specified. So if the first predictor X should also have a quadratic term, an X squared term, or some sort of nonlinear term, and you don't put the nonlinear term in, you've already got a problem. You're going to optimize the wrong model. So one of the beautiful ways to do this is what's called a marginal model plot, a marginal model plot. So you'll see two curves, a blue curve, which is actually just a non-parametric regression curve of the data. So that's a non-parametric regression curve for the log non-zero 12-month gas production as a function of log propane. And you can see that that looks like a bit of a U with a tail on it. Now, if you look at the smooth of the fitted values of the predicted values from the first order model, that's the red curve, and that's something that's just a little bit different from, that's a more gentle curve, increasing curve. And it makes sense that the red curve is just an increasing curve because all we've put in the model is linear terms. Now, because the blue and the red curve do not match at all, especially at the low end, we say that the first order model is invalid. Now, you can check this for all the predictors, and there are a whole bunch of them for which the blue curve and the red curve doesn't matter. It doesn't match, and so the model is just woefully invalid. So what I did for simplicity was include second order terms. So I included propane squared. I included frac fluid squared. I included interaction. And then if you look at marginal model plots here the first and second order terms, they're in green. So compare the blue curve with the green curve, you can see that the second order model here, the green and the blue curves match pretty well. They're not perfect, but if you get experience of doing these, they match pretty well. They don't match so well at the end, and the trouble with there is that there are some outliers in that log proper. But that's a story for another day. So if you look at the surface, where on the in the vertical direction we have log production, and the two other axes are log frac fluid and log propane, you can see you want to be in one of the corners. So because the initial focus was on propane and frac fluid, the second order model finds that 12-month gas production is maximized for high values of propane and low values of frac fluid. And given propane is expensive, that's really interesting. I'm still a bit worried about this model because I haven't taken account of outliers, and there are a bunch, and I've made assumptions that the model is only going to be up to second order. So one of the things we could do next is we could look at multiple adaptive regression spots, so-called MARS. And what you do is you put these in pairs. Let's look at the gold curve, X minus T plus, which is the line X minus T if X is greater than T, and it's zero if it's before. So what we're going to do is fit a series of broken sticks to the data. So a series of straight lines, just in any one dimension. And if we do the blue, the T minus X, we do the mirror image, we don't have multicollinearity issues. So it's easier to do the variable selection to predict, to pick which knot to put in. The trouble with splines is they're a beautiful thing. The hard thing is to figure out where to put the knot. So what MARS does is it builds forward and then it does variable selection backwards. So if we look at the first circle, you put a constant in the model, and then imagine we have the predictors X1, X2, up to XP. We're going to add each of those one at a time and figure out which set of matching splines makes the residual sum of squares as small as possible. And here, the red, that's in red, you can see it's going to pick X2. So then you put an X2 spline in the model, then you refit, and then it's going to pick an X1. And you keep doing this until the residual sum of squares no longer decrease. So this is a greedy algorithm, and you've way overfit the data. So what you can do, and what you're supposed to do, is then use variable selection on the holdout data to trim off, to build backwards, to reduce the number of splines. Now, you can do, you can include interaction terms, the whole nine yards. And if you look at the example that we just discussed, it turns out that the splines give a very similar solution to the second order model. which for me makes me feel much more comfortable going with that model because I've used this as another validity check. All right. And let's look at a fun example that I love to use in class that illustrates how well splines can work sometimes. So back in 2009, the NFL decided that it was going to ask fans to rate individual games. They wanted to understand what sort of games did fans love. And they gave you a gauge where 0 being a forgettable game and 100 being a memorable game, and you actually moved the gauge to a number. And they collected this on every game. And these folks published an article in the Journal of Sports Economics. I wrote to them and asked them for the data, and they never responded to me. So I thought, okay, I'm going to get my own set of data. But anyway, this is the model that they did. What they did was actually just use linear terms. So in the first simple model, the margin of victory, so blowout games are less memorable. Combined score has a positive coefficient. So if it's a high-scoring close game, you get more points. And the ultimate nirvana is if it goes to overtime, you get 9 points out of 100. But if you look at the Y variable fan rating and the total points scored, that doesn't look very linear to me. In fact, it looks like you should fit that with at least 2 straight lines. So as I said, what I did was actually have a research assistant scrape all the data for 256 NFL games. Now, some of the games on national TV were rated by tens of thousands of people, and some games were only rated by something like 8 people. You have to use a weighted approach. And notice here there are only 256 games. So here we have all the data. It's big data by definition, but it's not really that large. So we want to understand how margin of victory, combined scores, some of team rankings, right, overtime, whether it was a division game, if New York is playing Dallas, here in Texas, everybody's talking about it, and then whether it was a late Sunday afternoon game because there are less games on, there are more early games and less games on Sunday afternoon, late, so more people can watch the later game. So here we go. Here's the spline. And if you look, what it does is the way to interpret this, so it's fit 20 splines, 20 bases, including an intercept, and it then said that it only needed 6 of those turns. So we put a knot for margin of victory at 16. It says that interest, the score goes down. The fans' rating of the game goes down as the margin of victory increases 16 and then stays flat. Now, for combined score, the knots at 57, it says the fan interest goes up until the combined score reaches 57 and flattens off. Overtime gets you 8 more points, and a Thursday night game is bad if you lose 8 points for that. So, if you actually look at what their model is and what the model with splines, the signs of the coefficients are quite similar, but the coefficients are different because of 2 things. One, the most important thing is they fit a series of straight lines, and what the splines tell you is that the functions here are not linear, that they're not linear. So the next issue I'd like to talk about is there's no free lunch with big data. There's really no free lunch. But having lots and lots of data gives you some other problems. So this is the New York City taxi trip data, which the New York City Taxi and Limousine Commission actually now publishes online. There was a guy called Wong, W-H-O-N-G, who a few years ago put in an open records request for the data. And then lots of people, including me, put in requests, and now they publish the data so everybody can download it. And then there's this airline database that I love, the DB1B, which is a 10% sample of all airline tickets in the US, and it's published once a quarter. So in the quarter I looked at, there were more than 11 million bookings. So a 10% sample is huge. It's just amazing. And then I have, what I'm going to talk about was published in 2016, and you can find it online, about applications of robust regression to big data problems. So I'm going to talk about robust regression, and there are many different estimates. It's there's still, the robustness community still fight with each other about what's the best estimate, which is really sad, because if they could have gotten together, maybe robustness would have had more of an impact. But as you'll see in this situation, robustness works great because there are outliers. So there are two basic ways to do this. In the first diagram at the top, we're going to reduce the vertical influence of an outlier. So we're going to just consider the Y value of the data point. If the Y value of the data point is too high or too low, then we're going to move it back, trim it back towards the line. In the bottom, which has sort of like two normal curves on it, we're also going to look at the X value. So if its X value is a long way away, so for instance, if the taxi distance, most of them are between 0 and 2 miles, and some of the distances are 200 miles, we're going to worry about those X equals 200 points, and we're going to reduce their influence as well. Now, for completeness, I've actually given the definitions of the estimate, but everybody has the slide, so I'm not going to go through those today. So in this study, what I did was I just considered one day. Other people wanted to use the data, and I was limited to around 50,000 data points because they wanted to use a system called R, and the robustness packages my colleagues at other places had couldn't handle massive data points in those days. So 50,000 data points, rate code 1 means standard city rate, rounded trip distance was less than 3 miles. So I wanted to, as you'll see why, I wanted to just look at short trips, and then I wanted the average trip speed to be greater than 25 miles an hour because I didn't want to take into account slow traffic or being stopped. So the way the fares worked at that particular time, the initial charge was $2.50, so the intercept should be $2.50, and then 50 cents for every one-fifth mile, so another $2.50 a mile. Or 50 cents for 60 seconds in slow traffic. So the way I did the average speed, it should get rid of most of the slow traffic or stopped data. Here's a plot of the data. And wow, have a look at this. There's a trip that's 0.6 miles that costs more than $50. There's another trip that's 0.8 miles that costs around $40. There's a trip that's 0 miles, somebody gets in and has an argument with the cab driver and gets out, and that's $20. So many researchers have looked at this data, and people estimate that 7 to 10% of the data are outliers, unusual things or errors. Now, we know what the answer is here. The median fare amount should be $2.50 initial charge plus $2.50 times the trip distance in miles. And here are the estimates. So let's look at the intercept. Least squares gets badly affected by outliers, and the red circle says it's about $2.27, and the green and the blue give you confidence limits. It's only the M, the old-fashioned M estimate, gives the intercept to be $2.50, and it recognizes and it finds that there's very little variability in that intercept estimate. But have a look at some of the others. $2.27, $2.45, $2.35, $2.40, and $2.42. But the thing that amazed me was how narrow the confidence interval is. How narrow. So if you looked at that, the standard interpretation is that the methods give significantly different numbers. Significantly different numbers. Now, let's go and look at the slope. This is the charge per mile, and least squares says it's around $2.60. Least trim squares says $2.55. Again, the M estimate gets it spot on at $2.50. The MM estimate and the S estimates are again too high. But the thing that's astonishing is the confidence intervals are very narrow. Even the least squares interval has a very narrow confidence level. So if you were looking at this and doing least squares, you would say the intercept somewhere between 225 and 230, and the slope is somewhere between $2.58 and $2.62. An incredible precision, but the answers are wrong. Let's look at the data from the DB1B file. We're going to focus on 78,905 single-passenger non-stop round-trip ticket itineraries on Southwest. So I wanted to remove all the other predictors because I wanted to just really have airfare versus miles flown. So that's why I picked round-trip, non-stop, single-passenger. Now, we want to model the fare on the y-axis from the x-axis. And if one thing is pretty clear, it's not a linear function, but have a look at all of these ticket prices that are close to zero. Well, they're because they're frequent flyer tickets. So the standard thing to do in the literature, a rule that's come in, is that any ticket is less than $50 is a frequent flyer or a staff ticket. So, for instance, if you're on a frequent flyer ticket, they sometimes charge you for your bag. And if you look at Southwest, their cheapest specials run around $50 or more. And if you look at this, you can run multiple adaptive regression splines, and you can see that two straight lines joined together are going to fit pretty well. And I chose the knot to be at 1,500. So I'm going to have a steeper line from 0 miles up to 1,500 miles, and then a less steep line after that. Okay, then let's look at the estimate. And you can see least trim square says for the up to 1,500 miles, we make the fare cost 6 cents a mile. If you look at least squares, it says the fare costs 14.5 cents a mile. If you look at the M estimate, it says it costs 12.5 cents a mile. Now, think about this from a business point of view. You're going to say it's 14.5 or 12.5 or 6 cents a mile, and they're just so astonishingly different, so astonishingly different. And the confidence intervals, again, are really, really narrow. Then if you look at the slope after 1,500 miles, which is much lower, again, the answers are all over the shop. 2 cents, 2.5 cents, 3 cents, 4 cents. So it's just astonishing that these confidence intervals are very narrow, implying high precision. But I don't believe that precision. I don't. So let's think about what's happened. So no account was taken of the time of the day. Was this a busy... Was it for people commuting home on Friday? What day of the week? What the two airports that they are? So that it's certainly flight different on price depending on the airport. The number of days before the flight the ticket was purchased, as you know, if you buy a ticket right before the flight, it's much more expensive. And then how many vacant seats were there at the time of booking? So you can see that there are very many other things that will affect. So there's going to be a substantial difference between two airfares with different values of those predictors, and there's likely to be strong dependence between the airfare of ticket purchased with similar combinations. So if I buy a ticket for 5 o'clock on Friday between Atlanta and New York, or Atlanta and Pittsburgh, the day before the flight, when there are very few vacant seats, and a number of other people do, our ticket price is presumably going to be very similar and very different for someone who bought a ticket 60 days before. So, it's amazing, it's a small world. Right when I was finishing this paper, this paper by the famous D.R. Cox, Box Cox Transformations, Cox Proportional Hazard Models, he's a superstar, wrote a paper actually looking at this issue of big data and precision. And I just give you two of his quotes. So-called big data are likely to have complex structure, implying that estimates for precision based on applying standard statistical procedures are likely to be misleading. With large amounts of data, direct use of standard statistical models will tend to produce estimates of apparently very high precision because strong implicit or implicit assumptions of at most weak dependence underlying such models. The most serious possibility of misinterpretation arises when the regression coefficients take very different values in different phase processes. It's like my example was made to fit his theory. So it's clear now that if you want to build models for big data, that you need to have a reasonable model that takes account of
dependent.
So that moves me on to the next set of examples where we start to model dependence explicitly, and I'm going to look at Chicago taxi fares. Last December, the open data portal of the City of Chicago published 109 million taxi fares, taxi trips in Chicago back from 2013 through November 2016. And the thing that was really interesting is that they had the taxi medallion number. So I could analyze this at a medallion level, at a small business level, and that's what I decided to do. So what I did was take monthly money through the taxi. So the green line is the 75th quantile. So if you order all the money made by medallion and pick the 75th quantile, the top 25%, that's the green line. If you pick the median, the middle value, that's the red line. And if you pick the bottom 25%, I call that Lazy Larry or Careless Casey, that's the blue line. So you can see the seasonality that's really obvious in the seasonality and dependence. It's really obvious in the And in the right-hand plot, you can see that a straight line with decreasing slope, where the slopes differ, fit the data well. So what I did was actually fit that model. Let's take the 75th percentile. It turns out that in the beginning of 2013, the $8,332 and change was the estimated typical 75th percentile. And then went down $53,000 a month. So they've gone from $8,000 to $5,000 a month in that time, in 4 years. And if you have a look at the model fit, where I've got an AR1 term that looks back at last month and an AR term of 12 months, which is stronger, the model fits remarkably well, remarkably well. So you can see why the option market for Chicago taxi medallions was $350,000 at the start of 2013, and now it's down to $50,000. So remember that number, 8,000 went down to 5,000. Let's look at what happened to the median. This is the second one. It went down only $33 a month. And it's interesting, they started at $59.57. The bottom 25% started at $3,500 and went down by about $32 a month. So the top has come off more than the bottom. But it's amazing to me that all the revenue through your taxi was just $3,500 a month, and that you have to subtract all the costs. It's not a good business. It's not a good business. And then what I wanted to finish with is a transfer function model. I love looking at examples where people make prognostications. And the Federal Reserve of St. Louis has this blog. They have this wonderful online database. And here they say, Canada's oil segments amount to 10% of GDP and 25% of exports, all of which go to the U.S. It's not too surprising that the U.S.-Canada exchange rate mirrors the price of oil. Mirrors. Hello, I'm getting excited. I think that's a pretty strong word. Trade between the countries is much more than oil, but many of Canada's other commodity exports have a price that's well correlated with the price of oil, etc. So, and they even provided the data. So what I want to do is predict from the monthly crude oil price, West Texas Intermediate, the exchange rate Canadian dollars in US dollars. And let's see if it mirrors. Now, if you look at the plot, the time series plot, the Canadian exchange rate is the top plot, and the oil price is the bottom plot. And to me, they look vaguely similar, but I wouldn't say one's a mirror image of the other. So in this case, we can look at the cross-correlation function. So the correlation between exchange rate and oil price at the same time is 0.848489, okay? And you can see that it goes down in both directions. But this cross-correlation plot is not very helpful because there's so many high cross-correlations. Anything above the blue line is statistically significant. So in transfer functioning modeling, what we're going to do first is pre-whiten the data. That is, we're going to find a model for X, for the oil price. And the model for the oil price is an AR1 difference model. Again, I won't go through all the details. You can look at that through the slides. So what we do is we actually pre-whiten the data by fitting the same AR1 difference model to the exchange rate. Now have a look at the cross-correlation plot, and suddenly there's really only one thing that pops out. That is the correlation at the same time of the pre-whitened data. So that says you only need to consider the simultaneous effects of oil price on exchange rate, and you come up with a model that, again, passes all of the goodness of fit tests. So it's here. I'm going to blow it up bigger on the next slide. That basically says that a weekly change in exchange rate is 0.0018 times the weekly change in oil price. Wow. But the coefficient, while very statistically significant, you know, has a t-statistic of almost 9, it's not practically significant. You need a $56 weekly change in oil price to get a 10-cent change in the exchange rate. So this is a model, while statistically significant, is not practically significant. So we're going to finish on a really happy note, but this is not a very good model. Now, a lot of my experience comes from supervising MS Analytics students. This is a class to about to graduate. It has around 40 students. I was the chair or the co-chair of 26 of these people's committees. And here's a list of some projects. So they really go across the board. One of the people is a senior manager in Social Security, and they are able to... This student produced a decision tree model that's able to predict 75% of the cases that were flagged as potentially fraudulent. It's extraordinary. I've signed an NDA, so I can't tell you how it works. The second guy is a guy that works for a marketing company in Austin, and he works for one of the military services. And you go to this web page, and you navigate through about joining. And he looked at the sequential clicking. It turns out it's different whether you use a phone, a tablet, or a computer. What's the optimal order? And there are some so-called death pages. And he doubled the rate at which people apply. Telecom cell towers, there are thousands of them in Texas. And there are tens of thousands of them around the country. It's really hard to predict utilization. And once the utilization gets above a certain point, the whole tower shuts down. Modeling the relationship between earned media activity and service engagement. Lots of cities have these bike share programs, City Bike in New York. You can get a very effective model that looks at time of the year, day of the week, and the weather. And what this student did was look at media activity, what's being said on Facebook, Twitter, and online. And there's something like a 10-week lag, but it has a very significant effect. And then let's finish with two oil and gas ones, and I'm actually going to show you some of the outputs from the last one. So one of the students developed a transfer function to predict the daily market rate for drilling rigs. So it was something like $20,000 before when the price of oil was high, and it's gone down to about $13,000. What he wants to be able to do is predict up to 12 weeks in advance what that price is going to be. And another student who works for a different oil service company wants to predict oil rig count. So how many counts are there going to be? How many oil rigs will there be in play in 12 weeks' time? And I want to quickly look at that student, because he took the data from Baker Hughes. So he has 440 weekly measurements. And he actually, his model, he believes, what he's shown is better than the current one. So he's got a startup company called Real Rig. So next week, realrig.com, you can, if you subscribe to this, you can actually get his prediction. So his transfer function model is the rig count in week T is a function of rig count in previous week, plus a function of two secret source ingredients, two inputs that he doesn't want to make public. So you have to search through lots of inputs, and then you have to figure out what the lag is, how many weeks ahead of time. Hopefully it's close to 12, because he wants to predict 12 weeks ahead. And then to finish off, here is his last Friday, He says the rig count in 12 weeks' time will be 12% more than it is today. So that's interesting. We'll see. The great thing about time series predictions is to get to see how you do. And then here's how he's done so far. So real rig is his prediction. They're in the green. The dark gray are the actuals. And the light gray is what he calls the leading industry forecast. And his so-called real rig has percent errors of 1-6%, and the others have 10-4%. Okay. So that's the quick cook's tour of things that I do. And I'm happy to open it up for questions and discussions. Thank you for your patience.
All right, Simon, thank you very much for a very interesting and informative talk. And let's see, maybe we can start with the audience that we have out there. Are there any questions for Professor Sheather? Anybody would like to ask a question? Simon, they do tend to be a bit shy.
a bit shy, yes, there you go.
Yeah, yeah. How about here? Any? We have an audience here, by the way, mostly graduate students, postdocs. Anybody have a question to Professor Sheather? Let me start maybe asking you the following question. So these days, as you know, especially being here at Carnegie Mellon, there's a lot of, in a way, hype, so to speak, with machine learning, particularly through neural networks. You did mention briefly some comparison, but could you maybe expand a little bit in your experience, sort of both the difference between the statistical type of models that you use versus the neural network-based type of approaches, and maybe the other one, to what extent could they really complement each other?
So they typically do complement each other, Ignacio. So what I would typically do is I would use a machine learning approach and a flexible modeling approach and see how much better you can do with machine learning. If the neural network outperforms the flexible model, then you'd certainly go with that. Well, and you'd want to find out in which circumstances it did and then to try and improve your regular model, because my experience every time, so we have a prize for the best project in analytics, and a prize from ConocoPhillips won it for class 2016, and he developed a model to maximize oil production, and he had a machine learning approach and a flexible modeling approach, and the machine learning approach was better in terms of prediction error by about 2%. But the model they used in the company that got presented right up to the CEO is the flexible modeling approach, because people can understand it. And this guy got promoted to chief data scientist, ConocoPhillips, and I've talked to him a lot. He says it's amazing. People can get on board with the flexible modeling approach, especially if it's built around subject matter expertise. So I like to do both. One of the questions I've looked at recently, there are 400 reasons to call the call center before people cancel. What are the top reasons? It's really difficult to even begin to fit a parametric model. So what I did was start with decision trees, and I got the 400 reasons down to about 15, and then I built the parametric model with that.
Okay, good. So yeah, you're really saying both. That's good. Any question here or out there in the audience?
I wanted to ask the follow-up question regarding these statistical models with optimization. So we've seen a lot of examples here about estimation of responses based on input parameters, but how would you go about decision-making itself? Is it still is something that you could also approach doing the statistical methods, or is it just combining it and then going to the optimization step with these statistical models?
I couldn't agree with you more. So, sir, if I had given a two-hour talk, I would have talked about the optimization step next. So when we teach students, there is an optimization course where they take their statistical models and then try and optimize the input. So you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. Okay. So imagine, again, if you have a poor model of demand, there's not much point trying to optimize production. But if you have an excellent model of demand,
then you can get a good optimization of production. They go hand in hand. You're absolutely correct.
Okay, but there are there any statistical methods to that would replace the optimization part, or is it or is not the intention of this part of these methods?
Well, usually in optimization you have constraints, right?
Yeah.
Right. So if you're going to have constraints, we're going to do some form of optimization subject to the constraint.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, again, in the interest of time, since we're almost 11 o'clock, let me again thank very much Professor Simon Sheather for your interesting talk. And again, thank you, Simon, for the excellent presentation. Thank you so much. Bye-bye. And thank you, everybody out there, for attending the talk. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Need to run.
Okay, so it's not recent. I thought it was like
I went out too late. That's unfortunate. Thank you.